In South Los Angeles, it's a large community, which kind of really shows the depth of poverty that still exists in the United States of America. And the fact is that there is global poverty of epidemic proportions, and there's also American poverty of epidemic proportions. And so we felt, as providers and activists in South Los Angeles, that we needed to create a model that would build a health and human rights movement in South LA. That's my declaration. So let me start off with the conditions in South LA. It's home to more than 1.5 million people. This is a lot of what the streets of South LA look like. It has the worst population health status in California and probably in the country. 41% of the population and 79% of children live below the poverty level. 48% of residents have no health insurance. 48% of all births are to teen mothers. Almost half of all the children living in Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, live in foster care. 22% of adults have diabetes, which is double that of South Africa. And 80% of the housing is substandard, slum housing. So most residents in South LA live in slum housing, which causes severe disease. I thought it would be interesting to compare South LA in the global context. The mortality rate, the infant mortality rate in South LA is double that of Cuba. The average life expectancy is 68 years old, which is the same as North Korea, and 10 years below the US national average. As I said, 22% of adults have diabetes compared to 10% in South Africa. The immunization rate is 75% compared to 91% in Brazil. So in our opinion, these are more than health disparities. These are flagrant violations of health and human rights. And it's in that context that we began to build a movement in South LA around these issues. And the question, of course, that we asked ourselves was, how do we impact, you know, such intractable conditions and generations of poverty? And obviously, after the midterm elections, a government increasingly hostile to the belief in the right to health. So we began an advocacy program, first at St. John's, which is a community health center, unlike most community health centers, that's very steeped in the principles of social justice. We provide 120,000 patient visits in South Los Angeles alone. And this project was a collaborative between St. John's, all of the other community health centers that provide services, seven other community health centers that provide services to more than 300,000 patients in South LA, Homeless Outreach Project, Esperanza Community Housing Corporation, which provides affordable housing but also trains community health workers from the community, Strategic Actions for Just Economy, which is a community organizing and tenants organizing program, Community Health Councils, which is an advocacy organization, and LA CAN, which is a homeless advocacy organization. And what we did at St. John's was we developed a joint program in social medicine, engaging the social determinants of health as part of our medical practice. And then we established the South Los Angeles Health and Human Rights Movement. Last year in June, we held the first annual Health and Human Rights Conference on June 5th. As you can see, the California Science Center was packed with close to 1,000 people. And we brought together activists, community residents, healthcare workers, foundation leaders, politicians, elected officials, to build a movement on the right to health and health and human rights in South Los Angeles as an example of what could be done around the world. In December 10th last year, International Human Rights Day, we established the South Los Angeles Declaration of Health and Human Rights. It involved hundreds of residents in drafting the declaration. We had meetings throughout South Los Angeles. It was unveiled at the auditorium of Martin Luther King Hospital, which had recently been closed down by the County Board of Supervisors. And it was signed by thousands of residents, elected officials, and community leaders. And it engages all of the social determinants of health. I mean, there's this very powerful preamble, but also has specific principles around the right to health, the right to behavioral health, the right to education and employment, the right to housing and safe environment, the right to food security, food sovereignty, and food safety, the right to dignity and safety. And as a result, we resolved certain things, which basically that says that we basically have the right to health and human rights, and that each of us pledges to oppose any legislation, campaign, process, or action that infringes on the basic rights of human beings in South LA and beyond, and to support such actions that promote these rights, and to actively participate in the design, implementation, monitoring, evaluation, and enforcement of policies and programs that advance health and human rights. And recently, this collaborative has been funded by some significant foundations in California to continue over a 10-year period to really build this as a social movement in South Los Angeles that can connect to the rest of the country and to the rest of the world. So the next step that we're engaged in is creating patient-centered right to health committees. And we want those patient-centered right to health committees, which will evolve organically from the community, to impact the clinic scope of practice, establish a healthcare constituency. We just went through a whole slew of budget cuts by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, which essentially eliminated safety net health funding for California. There was no voice that could fight against that. And we're partnering with labor to advance advocacy through patient and healthcare worker joint advocacy and action. So the fact that we're bringing together a labor community alliance, which is now moving statewide and nationwide, is something that we're very involved in. These right to health committees, which are just beginning, are going to be part of a campaign that we're going to launch, a national campaign at our next conference, to put the Republicans on notice that we will not allow them to dismantle health reform. As weak as it was a step forward in the right direction, and it will significantly improve access for millions and millions of Americans, and we are beginning a national campaign to put those politicians on notice that we will not tolerate the dismantling of health reform at this time. So our second annual Health and Human Rights Conference will be on Friday, December 10th, International Human Rights Day, at the Los Angeles Convention Center. And what's important about that is that the LA Convention Center is huge, like the Denver Convention Center. And given the tremendous response that we had from the community and from activists in South Los Angeles, we will be doing this at a much, much larger venue than we did last year. And also, we, again, as I said, we hope to have this launch a national campaign to really advocate and build a constituency for the right to health. There is no belief on the part of most elected officials that healthcare is a fundamental right in the United States. There is that belief in other countries around the world, but there is no health and human rights movement in the United States. And we believe that by targeting South Los Angeles and using that as an example, we can begin to build that health and human rights movement. One of the exciting things about this conference is it's going to bring together both national and international leaders. Violeta Menjivar, Dr. Violeta Menjivar, who is the Minister of Health for El Salvador and the chairperson of the FMLN, is one of the keynote speakers at this event. We'll be traveling from El Salvador. I'm actually going to El Salvador on Friday to meet with her and her staff to prepare for this presentation and for this conference. So we're bringing together leaders from Kenya and Zimbabwe and across the world to this conference so that we can bring together the local efforts in South Los Angeles with national and international efforts around the world. So thank you very much.
For the children's, you mentioned that you were, I assume that you receive about 40% of your funding from
It's not true, though. Let me just...
Well, can you say a little bit more about that? I have to confess that I sort of paused, and you didn't give any examples. I don't know if they give these donations anonymously of the businesses that you find.
No, of course not. So it's 60, I said it's 62% from youth, and we're also seeking corporate donation. There's a lot of adults, folks like us, that also contribute. And then there's kind of philanthropic foundations and places like that. I'm not exactly sure off the top of my head of the number of corporate donation, but it's really small. And within that, we go through this corporate vetting system. So businesses are tough. It's really tough to kind of find businesses that we feel really comfortable with that aren't violating something that violates our mission, because our mission is so broad. It's about rights. It's about justice. So the corporations, for the most part, the businesses that we have partnered with are the leaders in social justice and social enterprise within the business community. But I don't know the exact number, but I would say less than 10% of our money comes from businesses. A lot of it's local business too, in particular areas. We do have some of the bigger businesses too, but for the most part, that's what the vetting system is there for. But it's no territory, we're trying to pioneer this for ourselves. Where do we go? Who do we take money from that we can do this amazing work on the other side with in the most beautiful people-centered way, and not feel like we sold out over here? It's just interesting. And Shelley and I, just like I said, we don't get to make that decision. What we're trying to do is steer that conversation in the strongest possible way, so that conversation's being had prior to any business partnerships being made.
Yes, ma'am.
It's out in it's in the Maasai region, and it borders Kipsigi, so it's out towards Tanzania. Shelly, do you know?
Kipsigi?
Yeah, it's kind of on the border there. Amori Joy is, I think, the town, the village that it's in.
In South LA is to, besides now expanding the conference to state and then eventually doing a national conference, the plan is to create these right to health committees. And we're going to create them based on neighborhoods. So they're going to we haven't decided how exactly, but we've already hired the community health promoters who will be organizing those committees. And we're going to have them in sections of South LA. And we're going to organize about a dozen of them within the next year. And then out of those committees will come what kind of activities they want to engage in, what the advocacy looks like, how they want to impact the primary care scope of practice and services that are provided in South LA. But I think the main activity is beginning to do an education and outreach campaign around the Declaration, which we're going to turn into a popular education piece, because that big long declaration is not something you're going to go door to door and ask folks to read. And then create these right to health committees based on that declaration.
So will you be posting some of these updating? Right.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff is on the website, yeah.
Can I say something in response?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, you mentioned PHM as well. We have a global right to health campaign, which is not, it's working in some countries. The very big one in India, which has been around the right to health care, which has involved essentially equipping community members with skills and tools to be able to monitor healthcare provision. So they sit outside clinics with checklists, when the doctor arrives, when he goes for his private practice, what the quality of care is like, and so on. And this has spread to become a national campaign, and has actually involved some of the national authorities, including the Human Rights Commission. Now, in some other countries, like South Africa, we've got very small right to health campaigns, which take a different form. In South Africa, we're involved with a few communities in Cape Town, and actually the right to health campaign in one of those communities is primarily presently focused on housing, because communities have identified that as one of the big social determinants of their ill health. So we're trying to do this, and I think it would be great in the US if we can partner with South LA, and perhaps Sarah can get into discussion with you, because I know that in different parts of North America, certainly on the west coast of Canada, there's an interesting right to health campaign operating there.
Let me reckon, Dr. Fine, and then.
I wanted to ask, in terms of the South LA movement, it's very exciting to hear you talk in terms of really healthcare as a human right. Have you thought of going beyond just a defense of the PPACA law to talking about a single payer national health insurance solution to what's going on? I mean, you're in a situation where you could really do the community education that would be necessary, it seems to me, to get that to be something that we might see happen in the United States.
Yes. At the first conference, there was a workshop on health reform, and basically it drafted a position in support of single payer. So I think that will be the goal, the ultimate goal of, and as far as education and these right to health committees, and clearly everyone at the conference and activists that came were all in support of single payer, and I think. You know, clearly the reason that we're in the process of defending health reform in its current state partly is because it didn't go far enough. And it didn't include a public option, for example, that could compete with the private insurance industry. So there was a way that it too easily compromised. So I think what we're hearing a lot from the community, and we continue to have these community meetings where hundreds and hundreds of residents participate, is that people are really worried about some particular pieces of health reform being rolled back. The expansion of Medicaid, for example, which is going to cover adults up to 133% of federal poverty. There's, you know, the funding of community health centers to triple the number of community health centers, primary care clinics throughout the country in underserved areas. I mean, those are some very important reforms that our residents are very, very alarmed about. But yes, the broader picture is certainly that that we need single payer, and that's clearly the goal, ultimate goal.
There was somebody else over here, Sarah, and then the two of you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to comment that there's a number of folks coordinating with NESRI, which is doing national right to health work also, to put together a complaint that's got specifics of different violations of the right to health in different parts of the country. And so that might be something that could be useful for your students. And if they haven't been in touch with you yet, they will be. So it's part of taking advantage of the structure that the U.S. is finding. Stay in touch on that, and we'll be reaching out to you. And if you sign up on the People's Health Movement listserv, we'll also
Yes.
Hi, yes, my name is Cricket, and I work with an organization called Results Educational Fund that actually, on our domestic poverty campaign, our major focus was around the expansion of community health centers during health reform. We have activists all over the U.S. that work on domestic health care, but also global. And Dr. Sanders, I was actually just wondering about, you spoke a lot about the different organizations that are actually working on global health, the federal funded and or corporate funded as well. And you talked about how many different evaluations that go through and the donor visits and the just the difficulties that countries go through in trying to actually accommodate all those new funds. I wonder if that really outweighs the actual successes that they're having for like the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and malaria particularly. And what are your solutions, or what would your advocacy solutions be to take that to the next level so that it's more integrated, perhaps?
That's a very difficult question. I mean,
we couldn't hear it at all back here.
Okay, the question is about question. I mean, what I showed briefly about the global health initiatives, these over 100 private-public partnerships, these have now become the face of donor assistance. Not only, there's still bilateral funding from countries, but these now occupy a large part of external donor assistance. So I suppose the fundamental question is, why do poor countries need donor assistance? Well, they need donor assistance because they don't commit enough of their budgets to health. And they don't commit enough of their budgets to health partly because they're committing their budgets to other things like military, but mainly because in many poor countries, even if they did commit large percentages of their budgets are so small because they're so low on the global international economic pecking order. So it's kind of a complex problem. But given this situation, I think it's very important for health activists to help governments understand better this very complex situation and to be able to argue for more control over how these funds are dispersed and how these organizations work. Because often they have boards in New York or Geneva which take decisions about how what are ultimately public funds are going to be distributed and for what. So there has been a lot of work done over the last few years looking at the impact of these. To answer your question, is it mainly positive? Is it mainly negative? I think it's mixed. I mean, PEPFAR funding, global fund funding, is responsible presently for funding most AIDS treatment, and that we should be thankful for. But I think it's a tragedy that countries cannot afford to fund their own AIDS programs, and they are very, very insecure, as I showed. If PEPFAR were to change its policies or the Global Fund were to stop funding, there'd be a lot of people with AIDS who don't have any treatment. So it's a kind of a very complex situation, and ultimately it's about countries' sovereignty and about their economic development, which leads us on to much bigger questions of political economy.
One more question. No, okay. All right. I think our time's up. Thank you, everyone, for attending.